Pleasure to be here. Let's talk this joint work with Heather Guy and the city manager and Aaron Kastner in places. I'm trying to be self-contained in this talk, so I'm going to talk as though you don't know the definition of the Kavanaugh phonology, but you'll pardon me, I'm going to speak up. So there are some papers you can find them on the archive that are related to this, some about virtual knot theory and some about the Arrow polynomial, which I will define in a moment, and other things. And I recall that knot theory can be based on Riemannian moves. And I recall the Bracker polynomial, usually written in this form, and normalized by multiplying by an appropriate, normalized by multiplying by an appropriate power of minus aq. Has been convenient to do this. This was what Kavanaugh rewrote this for his purposes. You can think of this rewriting in the following way, you take the bracket and you multiply it by a to the minus c of k, where c is the number of crossings. That, of course, will eliminate an a here and put an a to the minus 2 over here, and then replace a to the minus 2 by minus q, and then the value of the loop will turn into q plus q inverse, which actually looks much more convenient in lots of ways. But of course, then the normalization changes a little bit, but I'm working with it in an unnormalized way here. When I write the bracket, I'm writing it in this form. Then I'm using Olivero's enhanced states, which means that each loop is also labeled with a plus one or a minus one, and so the value of the loop is equal to the sum of q plus q inverse, where one q is coming from a loop with a plus one label and the other q is coming from a loop with a minus one label. This is convenient for various reasons, some of which are extremely elementary, such as the fact that if you have two loops and it was labeled the contribution from the two loops together would be q plus q into the square. But of course, enhancing in this way circumvents the binomial theorem, because when you add up all of these correctly, you get exactly q plus q inverse squared, or q plus q inverse to the nth in general. It will be convenient to replace minus 1 by x shortly, leave plus 1 as 1, as you probably know. If I had an enhanced state, it would be labeled with 1s and x's, and there would be some smoothings. And the smoothings, if they're B-type smoothings, are going to contribute a minus q. And if they're A-type smoothings, they just contribute a 1. And there we are with some monomial labeling the state. So each one of the enhanced states is labeled by some monomial in q and a sign. So the polynomial evaluates as a sum like this, a sum over the enhanced states of q to the j and minus 1 to the I. And what are J and I, just for the sake of doing an exercise here? I is, of course, equal to the number of B-type smoothings. And J is going to be equal to the number of B-type smoothings plus the number of circles that are labeled plus 1 minus the number of circles that are labeled minus 1. So that's the formula. Nice formula in terms of the sum of monomials for the bracket polynomial. This slide just says the same thing, except one more thing, that is we could collect up all of the enhanced states that have a given I and a given J and make a module out of them and call it Cij, and then the sum would look like this, sum over minus 1 to the I, Q to J dimension of that module. As it turns out, that module is the module for the chain complex for Kavanaugh homology, and I'll remind you how it happens. In the boundary operator, the I goes up and the J remains the same. So that means that for each J, there's a subcomplex, And so if I rewrote that same sum of monomials in this fashion, I would have written it as the sum of q to the j times the order characteristics of those subcomplexes. And as I said, Lobanov's definition gives a real homology theory there. And so the order characteristic of C is the same as the order characteristic of its homology. And in this form, the Jones polynomial becomes a polynomial whose coefficients are Euler characteristics of these homologies. So that's the formalism. And now a short digression for a few minutes, because I think this is a sort of cute idea and I'm playing with it recently. And that is, consider the following idea. Let's let C of K, which is the chain space here, it's spanned by the enhanced states, and take it over to complex numbers for the time being. And so this is the Hilbert space whose basis is ket S, where S runs over the enhanced states, all right? And they're taken to be orthonormal. So then I can define a unitary transformation on C of K by multiplying by the corresponding monomial that's the monomial that contributes to the polynomial. So this is a unitary if Q is on the unit circle. So this is a very simple jump to a little Hilbert space and a unitary transformation whose trace is exactly the bracket. That means that you can think of this as this small jump going through the Kramanov complex as taking you over to the arena of quantum computing, if you want to think about quantum computing. Now, the computing that we're going to be talking about here for about 2 minutes is not efficient. It's just that it's a small jump which takes you conceptually over to that kind of context, because in that context one wants to translate an algorithm of a classical type or of a quantum topology type into something which could be expressed in terms of quantum physics, and you need a unitary transformation. So here's one, and the trace of it is equal to U, and so you can, if you want to, explain how to build a quantum computer in the abstract that will compute the Jones polynomial by having it compute the trace of this matrix. Actually, that's all I wanted to say. It's just interesting to play with this, but let me say two more words about it. As I said, the trace of that unitary is certainly K, because we defined it that way, and I could, if I want to, even get it to be a single inner product element with a certain sum over the states placed in that fashion. So it's a psi u psi inner product is actually the value of K. And then there's a test, which is essentially an abstract quantum computer that can find the value of that. And I just remind you of how that, or just tell you for a moment how that looks. This is the end of the digression almost. You can set up an abstract quantum computer in the sense that you set up a certain unitary transformation, and then you measure the result of putting an input to it and find out what the probability is of getting a certain result out of it. That's the abstract version of a quantum computer. And in this case, it's called the Hadamard test. You take an arbitrary unitary, you make it controlled by putting in one more tensor line, so that when that line is a zero, it's the identity. When that line is a one, U is on. You run an input into it through a certain matrix, which happens to be called Hadamard, H there, and then run H through the line again at the end and measure and do a calculation, and you find out that you will get an output, of course, which is zero tensor something plus one tensor something, and the zero occurs with this probability over here and that this probability over here. And that means that psi u psi, the real part of it, can be computed. That is, statistically. And by changing a phase up in there, you can compute it. You can compute the imaginary part as well. So that means that the psi u psi can be determined by a series of experiments done on this machine, if the machine could be built, which doesn't know the interior of the black box. So this could be very useful if you were doing it on somebody that was interesting to construct and relatively efficient to construct. In the case that we've given, it's a conceptual loop over here and takes you directly into this situation, but it's not so efficient. A more efficient method is, for example, due to Von Jones and Dorit Aharonov and Landau, where they use a braid group representation that's very nice and get the Jones polynomial as the trace of a certain unitary braid group representation, and then you get a more efficient algorithm. But this is a nice way of drawing on a postage stamp how to get from the Jones polynomial over to a quantum context for it and such a thing. So I just thought I'd take a digression into that for a moment, and I'll leave my digression now with the following remark. The way we reformulated it, you see, those Qs are eigenvalues for C0. The boundary operator keeps switching the sign because of the minus 1 to the j. And so you go through the eigenvalues switching sign down through in any one of the complexes involved. And the chain space is the sum over the eigenvalues. The chain space is the sum over the eigenvalues, and so the value of the bracket polynomial from the point of view of that unitary transformation is the sum over the eigenvalues multiplied by the other characteristics of the pieces of homology. And I like that picture that came out of it and hope to reformulate things further so that the picture has more meaning. But that's the picture that comes out of rewriting things in terms of this unitary transformation. That's the end of the direction. I just summarized it here. So now let's recall how quantum homology is defined. So one way to think about it is to look at the states and put them into this nice cubical shape and then say, cubes remind me of homology, and I would like to somehow define homology in terms of this. And this is a category, and the category consists of objects, which are the individual states, and arrows, which correspond to smoothing one site. And then, if you were thinking of this as an abstract cubical category, then you could imagine assigning homology to it by taking a functor from that category to a category of modules, so that each object in the category goes to some module, and each morphism in the category is a partial piece of a boundary mapping, and the boundary mapping from any given part of the module to the next part of the module is the sum alternating, if you're keeping track of signs, of the maps that go from one place to the other. And then you need some compatibility of morphisms, you know, like these two should compose to give you the same result as these two, or with appropriate switch and sign, in order to get boundary equals zero. And so from here, you can try to create the corresponding map to modules. And if you want to create a map to modules, then it would be natural to take each one of these circles to a certain module. And then, to make a long story short, two issues come up that wouldn't come up in the abstract, but come up here because of the fact that we're the objects in the category are these states that are collections of circles. And that issue is that when you map a given module by re-smoothing an A into a B, you will get either two circles or you will get one circle, and consequently the map on the module, there are two kinds of maps on that module that are needed. One is looking like a co-product and the other is looking like a multiplication. And so with that, it turns out that the following algebra works just beautifully and is Kovanov's original definition, that you let the module that's associated with a single loop be generated by a 1 and an x, so that x squared is equal to 0, And now we're back over z, not over the complex numbers. So this is the polynomial ring in x modulo x squared. And the co-product is x goes to x tensor x, and 1 goes to 1 tensor x plus x tensor 1. And that defines this chain complex. And everything works remarkably. And furthermore, the j that we defined remains constant, which is a nice exercise. So, so this decomposes exactly as advertised into a collection of subcomplexes, and the bracket polynomial ends up being having its coefficients or the characteristics of these pieces. So that's the definition. And that's a summary of what I just said again. And now, with that definition under our belts, let's talk about the Arrow polynomial. Now, the Arrow polynomial is a generalization of the Jones polynomial that comes from staring at it and putting the orientations back in the diagrams and wondering whether you could keep track of more information if you watch the orientations. So if you use the bracket expansion and expand it, keeping track of orientations, then you get one normal smoothing and one disoriented smoothing like this. And you could ask yourself, what will happen if I try to keep track of some of this stuff rather than just throw it away? You can just throw it away and you will calculate the usual bracket polynomial. That is, you keep it all the way down to the end and you have peculiarly oriented loops. And then you just evaluate each loop in the usual way. That's one way to deal with things. But on the other hand, you could say, I'll go back through the proof of invariance and see whether I could keep some of this combinatorics. Now, for my own purposes, I have two levels of playing with this. One is that I wanted to keep these two together as though they were one single node but were separated for purposes of thinking about this. And that would mean that if you followed something like that down, then you would try to keep these nodes attracted to one another and see whether you could keep them stuck together all the way through and find some rules. You would find some rules that said you had to unstick them at certain points, and you would end up with some four-valent graphs in the end where the nodes were still stuck together. That's a little more complicated, and actually, as far as I'm concerned, needs more work. It's called extended bracket polynomial. And it's interesting, but definitely more complicated. A simpler procedure here to look for patterns of invariance is to allow these to be separate immediately. So that means that all the state loops are separated from one another, but each state loop has some zigzagging and some cusps on it. And then try to figure out what you have to do with them in order to make it invariant. Up till now, I'm not even wondering. I'm not even assuming that I'm out of the plane. I'm just doing this in the usual way. And this is the answer you will arrive at. You will find that you need to cancel consecutive cusps, where you see each cusp as you built it points to one side of the local arc in the plane that is involved. So when I say consecutive cusps, I mean that they're both pointing to the same side. And those should be canceled. You'll see why in a moment. And on the other hand, if you have a zigzagging cusp like this, then you don't need to cancel it. I'll show you the proof in a moment, but after you've gone through that proof, you might think, oh, I have now apparently added infinitely many variables to the Jones polynomial, namely this one, which has a non-canceling zigzag, and here's a two zigzags, and K3 would have three zigzags, and so on. Yeah, and it looks like you have somehow contrived to add infinitely many variables to something which was originally only one variable. However, if you now experiment with that a little bit, you see that it can't work in the plane. You see, if you had something like this, remember these both go in and these will both go out, and this is a typical cusp situation. And now you think about, well, what could I pair this with? Because it did have to be paired with somebody originally, and try to build, and you find that you're always one odd man out because each one of the states is a Jordan curve in the plane. So it will not give you anything interesting in the plane. And I'll just point out to you, since you might imagine it, this does depend on the fact that these orientations are in. You might think, well, what about this? That seems to work. But then if you look at how the orientations are assigned, these going in has to be paired with guys going out. But these are going in, and so are these going in, and this doesn't pair. So if you experiment with it a little bit, you'll see that it doesn't work in the plane at all. And you didn't actually generalize the Jones polynomial at all in the plane. However, if you go to surfaces, I thought I had the surface slide there, but let's just jump across this proof for a moment and come back to it. There. So if you went to knots that are embedded in a surface cross I, and a knot that's embedded in a surface cross the unit interval can have a diagram that's simply drawn on the surface like you draw on the plane. So then you see that you can, and this isn't actually the one that I wanted to show you. I might as well draw the one I wanted to show you that's a little neater for illustrating the point. Same phenomenon. There. So I'm just saying that it very naturally happens as soon as you're looking at diagrams on surfaces that you can have states that irreducibly have zigzags in them, right? Let's leave that and go backwards on the slideshow. So you see, that tells you immediately whether or not you have come up with some definition of virtual knot theory, which I'll mention in a moment, that the Jones polynomial has the property, if you think about orientations for it, that it sort of naturally wants, as soon as the orientations are there, to be put onto surfaces and have more variables and more discrimination on the surfaces than just evaluating the loops. So you could take this as a result that says we can make a polynomial for knots in any given surface in this way. I'm going to put it into virtual knot theory context for convenience, but it really is an invariant that lives on surfaces. And if you're thinking about generalizing to surfaces, then you can go a little further as well, because each one of the state loops could be regarded as a certain isotopic class of loops in the surface, and then you add even more variables if you want to. But if you only want to add the zigzagging information, then you don't have to know exactly what surface you're on. So let's see how this happened. Let's just take a minute and see how this happened. So if you look at the oriented expansion for a two-move, then if it is same direction of two-move like this one, then you get three things which should cancel one another. But in order for them to cancel one another, you're going to need that this loop, which has two consecutive cusps, should be the same as an ordinary loop. So there's the first evidence that we ought to have consecutive cusps canceling. Then these three cancel each other out, and we end up with what we want. Then if you take the reverse two move and see what it's telling you, this is an ordinary loop. Here's two consecutive cusps also, and they need to pull out to become an ordinary little bit of arc, and similarly here. And then here's two consecutive cusps that should be canceled in order to get the invariance. So you see that in order to have the second move invariance, the rule I stated has to be the case. But then what about the third move? And if you look at one side of the third move, and by the way, you only need to use the oriented third move in the presence of both of those reversed oriented two moves. So you look at the third move, and you get a little collection of things that vanish, and then you see that there's some zigzags in there, but the zigzags occur symmetrically so that they will occur exactly the same on both sides of the two move, and of the three move, and consequently they pursue their way through the three move without having to be disturbed, and that is why it ends up the way it is, with the zigzags being counted all the way down to the end. Then let me review a little bit about virtual knot theory. So virtual knot theory is really the idea of doing knots on surfaces, but then if you have a structure where you don't care so much about the other handles in the surface or the way the state loops are embedded in the surface, then you could ignore them a bit. And just use a diagram that corresponds to, essentially, to projecting the knot out into the plane like that. And then you will get some extra crossings which are neither open or under because you projected them from crossings which were just on one part of the surface or another and they projected into the plane. So you end up with some virtual crossings. And then there's a reconstruction that lets you go back and forth, because if you have a diagram in the plane like this one, then you can take a little neighborhood of it in the plane by taking a pair of ribbons for each virtual crossing that don't touch one another, and a little bit of ribbon neighborhood for each of the ordinary crossings, and reconstruct and construct a well-defined surface from the diagram on which it sits, and then add two cells to the boundary of that, and you will have the surface. You will have the knot sitting on the surface. But of course, if you do a Rademeister move on the, if you do some move on the diagram, then you may get a different surface, and so then the answer to the question of what you're doing is that you're taking it up to surgeries on handles on the surface that don't cut through the knot, and then you have the following diagrammatic for it. You can simply use the virtual crossings in the plane and move them around as though they were flat, and move them around to detour them across real crossings. So, in other words, the virtual knots are defined up to ordinary Rademeister moves on the diagrams and detour moves that correspond to the virtual crossings, so that they read virtual crossings don't really mean anything except connection between the different classical crossings. Okay, so then there are some nice phenomena. One of them is the following, that if you calculate the bracket polynomial for this example, you will see, when you expand it, that it has exactly the same result as this guy. That is, what happens when you expand it, you can do it in your head. You just expand it by A this way, and A inverse when you smooth it that way. When you do the A, this gives you a little two move on the virtual crossings, and they pull apart. And if you did it and you do the B expansion, you get a couple of little loops, and they disappear, and you end up with exactly the same thing as the expansion of this. So it's invariant under flanking a crossing with two virtuals, which we call Z equivalents. And that means what? Well, this guy over here on the left is a very non-trivial virtual knot, but that requires some checking. This guy on the right is just an unknot. So this has trivial Jones polynomial, and it means that you get infinitely many examples of virtual knots with trivial Jones polynomials, and none of which are classical as far as I know, but that's a conjecture. Another conjecture is the following. Does classical knot theory is known to embed in virtual knot theory? The open question, as far as I know, is does classical knot theory embed in virtual knot theory modulo Z equivalents, where you're allowed to do that thing? And that seems harder. Now, getting back to the Arrow polynomial, it can be formulated in virtual knot theory. very convenient invariant in that you can calculate it just about as easily as the bracket. You just keep track of certain orientations in the states and see what they are, whether they're K1, K2, and so on, and you get more variables. And so a typical, a typical calculation might look like that, where you have some KIs. And this calculation, in fact, is the calculation for the Kishino diagram, which is notorious because it's always been a little hard to check that it's non-trivial. But in this case, it comes out easily. The invariant is also an invariant for flat virtual knots and links, virtual strings, if you like. So now I want to make another digression about, we'll get to the categorification near the end. I want to make another digression about parity, which is another way to add structure here. Parity is indigenous to virtual knots because of the fact that as soon as you have diagrams of this kind, or Gauss codes of this kind, arbitrary Gauss codes, in the Gauss code you can have a number of chords that intersect, a chord that's intersected by an odd number of other chords. In the diagram, you can have a crossing, like crossing number one, which when you take the trip around and see how many crosses you go through before you come back to number one, it's odd. So call a crossing odd if it has the property, it has that property. Doesn't happen for classical knots, happens here. And a simple invariant of that, of this kind, is to define the odd drive. The odd drive is the sum of the signs of the odd crossings, and here you get minus 2, and you find easily enough that the odd ride is an invariant of the virtual knot. So this is a quick proof that this virtual knot is indeed not classical, nor equivalent to its mirror image. Now the reason I mention parity is because you can do a lot with parity, here's a nice example of working with parity in relation to an invariant. Monturov suggested the following. Take the bracket and take the bracket and on an even crossing, expand it in the usual way, but on an odd crossing, make it into a vertex. And then these pairs of vertices in these graphs will cancel by two moves. They will reduce by two moves. And then you can see easily enough that this is invariant. The virtuals. And in the case of the Kishino, they're all odd. And so you just get a little graph down to the bottom of the calculation, and you end up with that proof that the Kishino is non-trivial. And other examples can be played with in a similar fashion, like this guy here has four odds and one even, and it's not hard to see that it's non-trivial. And furthermore, by arguing about it a little bit, you can see that it isn't Z equivalent to a classical knot. But it has a trivial, has a unit Jones polynomial. So we conjectured a long time ago that unit Jones polynomial knots ought to be Z equivalent to a classical, and that's false by this example and many others. Other examples of error computation look like this, of course. You will get some states which are which have k's and expand away. This slide I'll skip. And now let's talk about categorification. I see I have plenty of time, actually. Maybe we'll go back to that slide. This is an interesting point. If you calculate on a long virtual knot, then you will get a long state. And a long state has some asymmetry with regard to the zigzags. You could have a zigzag or a zag-zig, and they're different. And that lets you prove various interesting facts about long virtual knots that you might not have thought to prove otherwise, you see. Because, for example, if I were to take this knot and turn it upside down, then I would get a zag-zig rather than a zigzag. And I would end up showing that the upside down version of this was different from the right side up version of it as a result. And so that's an extra fill-up that these states have when you're doing longs. So then, if you're thinking about categorifying the error polynomial, and I should mention, by the way, that the error polynomial, the basic idea for the error polynomial occurs in the work of Miyazawa on his polynomials, maybe obscured at the beginning a little bit by the way he was defining things, and then eventually, if you look at his papers, you'll see that he comes to the same concept exactly. So, what's called the Miyazawa polynomial, I think, is exactly the same as this, possibly with some change of variable as the error polynomial. If we're thinking about categorifying, then it's natural to ask, what happens to the arrow count? So I have the arrow number of a state is the number of zigzags in it. And what happens to the arrow count when you meld two loops or when two loops split apart? You find that this is the answer, all right? That if one is m and the other is m, then you will either get absolute n plus m or absolute n minus m for the absolute value of that, for the total number. And similarly here, if it's n plus m or n minus m, then it goes to n and n. So you see, things work nicely modulo 2. And one should think about what happens when you have a single loop, and that's a little more complicated and the parity is shifted out a little bit. But what we do when we have a... that leads to a problem, actually. If you wanted to do a generalization of Kovanoff homology for virtual knots over the integers, then you need to worry about these mappings, the single loop to single loop mapping. You need to worry about it because certain compositions of them will happen, and composing in the other direction on certain examples, you will get something that's non-trivial. I don't think I made a slide of the standard example that one worries about. But then over the integers, you find that there's something to construct. And Monturov made a very nice construction for integer version of Kovanoff homology. But his integer version of Kovanoff homology for virtuals runs a cropper on this kind of not a change of parity that's going on here. So we don't know how to do it over the integers, but we do know how to do some things modulo 2. So the thing I'm going to describe is going to be for Kovanoff homology modulo 2. And there everything works fine originally as well for virtual knots. It's not a problem with it. We're going to count the error number on each state loop modulo 2, and we're going to add an extra decoration to the state, a dot, if you like. So every state loop has a dot in it, or no dot in it, according to whether or not it has an error number that's odd or even. It is the fact that if you had some method of dotting the states that was additive with respect to 2 to 1 bifurcations and so on mod 2, and behave well with respect to the ordinary Rademeister moves, then you could extend the Kovanoff homology in the following simple way. You can define a new grading to be the number of loops that have an x and a dot minus the number of loops that have a 1 and a dot. Where the dot is means that there's an odd number and there's an odd arrow number. And then ask that the boundary preserve that grading and throw away things that don't preserve that grading, working mod 2. And that's the main categorification that we're working with. We're calculating some examples in that version. There's a more complicated version in the paper that we wrote, but I won't bother you with it because we haven't, meaning Aaron and myself, Aaron Kastner and myself, haven't found any examples where it does better than this. So this is a simple way to add the extra information that's in the error polynomial to get a categorified version categorified in the sense that there's a homology, not categorified in the sense that we retrieve the error polynomial. And this homology has some nice properties. So, for example, here's one knot, and here's another one, and these two are not distinguished by mod 2 Kovanoff homology, or by the Arrow polynomial, or I think by Kovanoff homology, period, but they are distinguished by this simple categorification of the error. So there are a slew of examples of this sort of pairs of knots which are not distinguished before, but are distinguished by this statute. Another example is this one, which isn't detected by what we're trying to do. And so that's a picture of this categorification of the Arrow polynomial that we're working with. There are lots of questions about it. We don't see knots that are unseen by the Arrow polynomial, but are seen by the Arrow categorification. There are lots and lots of knots that are not seen by the Arrow. And we don't really understand how the examples are managing to have the same invariance when they do have the same invariance, and exactly what is being distinguished when they are distinguished. One can add parity to the Arrow polynomial and to the categorified version of the Arrow polynomial in a way that's just similar to what I was describing by that kind of adding a graphical node when the crossing is odd. And we're working on that. So you'll see some more about that from myself and Aaron. A philosophical question is, how does this kind of construction reflect on the problem of whether the Jones polynomial detects the unknot? I ask that because the question of whether the Jones polynomial detects the unknot is still open, and it's still the case that you might imagine finding a counterexample to it as a virtual knot which happens to have trivial Jones polynomial, but also manages to be manipulatable so that the handles disappear and it ends up being classical. And how does the Arrow categorification information reflect on the fact that Kovanoff homology does detect the unknown? I see I'm finishing a little early, but that's it.
So just a ordinary bracket, we know there's really interesting numbers you can put in for A. Do you have any other interesting numbers you can put in for your K variables?
I haven't thought about it. Good question. You have any ideas for good numbers?
I think about it. I might have some ideas.
Okay. What is the relation of this? Is there any relation of these unoriented version of Kovanoff homology by Clark, Morrison, Walker?
Right, I'm aware of the question and I keep meaning to look carefully at it. But that's a good question. Because
they did it only for classical modes, but they also have the invariant exactly.
But they also have a parameter that you need to post with unity. There's another point which you can probably remind me about. I mean, they were motivated partly by a discrepancy between the way we combinatorially write the bracket polynomial and some things that happen in the quantum group, right? When you're the SO2 quantum group. And I've forgotten what that point is, so you could remind me.
Of course,
yeah,
as long as it's between B and B.
But at the same time, you created a different.